The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have a 90-minute show tonight. Our guest is Bob Zimmerman. This will be the last time he's on for 2020, which is really a weird thing to say. This year seems to have gone really fast, but during the year it sure didn't seem to be going fast. 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number. You can also reach us at Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post on our blog, and as soon as I get the comments through you're hitting the right button on the blog, I can implement it and read it on the air. So you go to thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for our upcoming show menu. Click on the very first show listed, which will be with Bob. And then you, like most blogs, scroll all the way down the bottom. You'll see a place for commentary and a button that says send or hit or something of that nature. And then I will get your message. But listeners, it is a talk show, so we do like to talk. I keep saying this all the time. And Bob is waiting for your phone calls, even while I'm doing the show's introduction. So don't disappoint us. We definitely want to get your calls. The newsletter is up. It's a full week on the Space Show, I think. I'm not certain about Hotel Mars because Mr. Batchelor was traveling and he has not responded, and we have not yet set up the show for tomorrow if there's going to be one. Everything we do is archived, and you can download quickly or listen offline and with the podcast. We have a great Friday program with Jim Betta and his co-author Karen, and they're from the Aerospace Corporation, and it's about their Space Solar Power Economic Paper that is published, and actually I have a link for it on the blog, so you can check it out. And then Sunday we have a great Space Show program for you as well, too. All of this is on the blog. Sunday, Kim of Moonwords brings us up to date with all the new work that she's been doing. And it's co-hosted by John Jossi. So it should be a lot of fun and should be very interesting. It is the holiday time, and if you're looking for stocking stuffer gifts or some kind of an unusual gift, try the Space Show store. You click on Pepper Listening to the Space Show, and there's all sorts of logo wear items in our Space Show store, which Pepper will take you into, and maybe you'll find just what you're looking for. Even if you don't, your feedback is always welcome, so maybe we can improve the store or get some other items in it. So let me know either way, but hopefully it works for you, and you can get some items that you can't get elsewhere. In the upper left, there is a menu for Listen Live. This is very important. It tells you how to listen to our live show, tells you how to listen to podcasts, and how to listen to compressed MP3s off of our website. And if you have any problems or any questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll be happy to help you as best as I can or troubleshoot any problems that you have. Also, we are in the midst of our fundraising campaign, which we do every year to the end of the year. And the Space Show continues to ask you for your support, financial support, as well as listening support. And we want to make the case. So I'm going to make it real quickly on Bob's nickel here. But you can listen to a lot of podcasts, and many of them are space-oriented, and many of them are excellent. I'm not kidding you. They're really good. How many of them do you get to talk to the guest? How many of them do you get to argue or debate with the guest? How many of them can you come on and promote your book that you self-published because nobody else will publish it? And or you can't find a publisher, but here you've got an outlet to promote it with a website and make some decent sales and even do autograph copies. How many of those podcasts can you do that with live, real time? I can keep going down the list. Should I do that? So if you want to have those features and those items available on a space-related program that is in-depth discussions, like with Bob tonight, will be around 90 minutes in-depth, then support us and help us. Okay, don't just listen and then sign off and say, great show, David, or lousy show, David. Support us. Step up and help us continue to bring this very unusual and unique format right into your home or to your device or your car, or wherever you may be listening live or on archives. And we do need your support. So we are a nonprofit with 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. If you are a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, join the club here. But you do get a tax deduction for your gift as well. And we need your support, and we look forward to it. And go to our nonprofit website, onegiantleapfoundation.org, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Just email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have sponsors. I'll talk about our sponsors when we take a break with Bob. So many of you know Bob. He's been the most frequent guest on the Space Show in Space Show's history. I don't think there's anybody who's even a close second to Bob. And he's written great books, and you've heard me introduce him before, and his bio is on the website. So if you're not familiar with him, go read about him on our website. It's right there on the show for today. But we want to talk to Bob and hear what's happening now. We got 2 weeks left of 2020, and I guess my first question, Bob, is, are we expecting anything monumental in the last 2 weeks of the year?
Well, rather than talk about the last 2 weeks, because, you know, it's just going to be the wrap-up. There'll be a bunch of launches. There's a few things going on, but I don't think anything monumental. But let's talk about 2020, and this will tie into your fundraiser, David, believe it or not, and the reason why people should send you money and support the Space Show. Because this year, the U.S., at this moment in time, has completed 39 successful orbital launches. That's the most orbital launches. I count only rockets that put a payload successfully into orbit in space or out of Earth orbit beyond. So we have 39 launches. That is the most launches in the United States achieved in a single year since 1968. Think about that. More than a half century, that was the height of the space race. That 68 was the winding down towards the Apollo 11 mission. So the U.S. was really aggressive in putting out a lot of launches. Actually, it wasn't even the high year in 68. But this is the most launches since then. And the fundamental difference between then and now is that in 1968 and in the early 60s, all of those launches, I should say all, 99% of those launches were government-paid, government launches for government payloads on rockets that were essentially government rockets. Because even though they were built by private enterprise in some manner or another, the rockets were under the supervision, control, and ownership of the government. And so the even though private companies could do commercial launches, they were really limited in how much they can do. So that was then, but now we've topped that record, at least for 69, and all of the launches this year, not some, all of the launches this year were commercially launched, private launches by privately owned rockets owned by private companies. Some, a handful, not a lot actually, but a handful were for the government. But the government was just simply buying a product from those rocket companies. And so the success this year is from private enterprise and commercial space. And now how this ties into the space show and why I've been on your show more than anybody else is because David Livingston and the space show was advocating private enterprise as a way to achieve real success in space for the future forever since the very, very beginning. And one of the reasons he has me on is we're of like mind in this, that the best way to do this is have a competitive, robust industry that's making money in space. And David is one of the reasons we've now transitioned to that, because he allowed people like me to say that over and over and over again for the last, what is it now, two decades, David? Almost two decades.
Two decades ago
was just after, was a few years after I published Genesis, the Story of Apollo 8, my first book. And in that book, I said unequivocally, it will be private space that will make us, that will finally get us to the stars. And David has allowed me to say that over the last 20 years. And there are plenty of people who disagree. But the proof is in the pudding, and in about 2 weeks, this may be the most monumental thing in the last next 2 weeks, I'm going to publish my yearly worldwide launch report, and I'm going to talk about how the pattern over the last 20 years is clearly for private space and not government.
It was unheard of when I started the space show. I mean, you had Boeing and Douglas and then ULA rockets that were made by private companies. You could buy stock in the companies. They're clearly private companies. But as you said, they were government decreed, government used, government owned. And there were people who tried to get the government rockets to do private missions. There were a couple of efforts, maybe they were crazy at the time, to get these rockets and launch to the to go to Mars, and the government wouldn't let them do it.
Yep.
There were people who wanted to go get the external tanks and turn them into space hotels back then. Again, maybe a harebrained idea, maybe not, but it never got off the ground because the government said, no, you can't have our external tanks.
There was a private commercial consortium that wanted to pay NASA to build a fifth shuttle at the very beginning
for commercial purposes only,
and they were turned down. The story I tell in Leaving Earth, my second book, about how late in the 90s when Dennis Tito wanted to become a tourist in space, he had the money to do it, he was willing to put his bucks down. The Russians had need of cash and were willing to fly him. It was NASA and Daniel Golden
who tried to stop him
and said, we can't have tourists, this is not commercial, this is government operation. And the one aspect that's different now than then, David, and you'll know this as well as me, is that I would do radio interviews or write essays, and the response I get from people for the idea of commercial space was incredulous disbelief, and that's absurd. You can't do that. That's ridiculous. And, of course, I'd say, my gosh, this is the United States, whoever's to them, and say, this is what our country was built on, the idea of freedom and private enterprise.
There's an interesting thing about that, because that response, of course, we got that too, and it was a serious response. But when I was writing my PhD dissertation, which had a big focus on space tourism, even though it was called Expanding Commercial Space, and then people were actually talking about space tourism, everybody laughed at it.
Yeah.
So on private launchers and commercial space, a very serious negative. On space tourism, a very serious giggle factor.
Yeah. Yeah,
from,
I mean,
from the
whole
same
just the idea, though, of a tourist, for example, going in space at the time of Dennis Tito. I can't tell you the number of radio interviews where I'd get someone who'd say to me, what right does that person have to go? And they say, this is the United States. What right do you have to stop him? He has the money. He's willing to pay for it. He should be allowed. You have no say in the matter.
In recent years, even on conservative talk radio, there's no reason for me to mention the names of the hosts, but I could. They've made fun of going to Mars. They've laughed at it. They've laughed at commercial rockets. They've laughed at Musk. They've even made glaring errors, like we're trying to go to Mars on an ICBM. You know, they've made really dumbass comments. I'm thinking of two commercial hosts in particular. And probably the last two or three years, I haven't heard him say a damn thing about any of it.
Yeah, I mean, well, there was a column I wrote for UPI back in 2004 when I was doing this column, and it was right after George Bush Jr. proposed his
Mars
crew exploration vehicle,
yeah,
and you know, retiring the shuttle, but with the proposal to go back to the moon and stay, and I know, and do it manned. And I noticed a very significant difference between that proposal and the press's response, and the response to his father's same exact proposal when George Bush Sr. was president, when it was just laughed off the face of the earth and dead on arrival. And then I said, the debate between manned space and robotic space is over. Manned space has won. Well, in the last decade, Elon Musk has fought his way forward to convince the world that commercial space is the way to go, not government space. And in this sense, right this moment, at this moment, it's not a firm victory, but right this moment, commercial space is demonstrating that it is the way to go. And without question, and that's now my annual report's going to talk about this at great length, because it's eminently clear historically over a long period of time, and within this year, and within the last decades, and within the last decade. And the fear I have, once again, is the new administration coming in and doing what you expect from a democratic administration: use the government to protect people and impose restrictions on what commercial space can do. And if that should happen, we will see a decline in commercial space.
Well, we're watching to see,
yeah,
if the regulatory regime is going to tighten up. But thank God it hasn't done so, and maybe it won't. And Musk is an amazing transformative character with his businesses, with Tesla as well, and what he's done. And man, without him, we'd probably still have commercial space, but without him, we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are today.
No, we're not even close. And you know, a good comparison is between him and Jeff Bezos, who has the same opportunity to be a transformative figure in his own right. And Bezos has so far been a failure in this. He has devoted as much capital, maybe more, in fact, probably more capital, on his Blue Origin company than Musk has on SpaceX. And the results from Blue Origin are more than disappointing. I can't. In fact, it's really tragically disappointing,
no,
considering
absolutely
how much money has been put into it, and their initial proposals, which made so much sense and followed in the same direction as Elon Musk in a smart way. And there's no reason not to compete. And it just hasn't been happening. Now, that doesn't mean it won't happen, and I really want it to happen. I'm not downplaying them. I'm not criticizing them to try to discourage it. I'm trying to get them to achieve something. But at the moment, they surely have been an incredible disappointment, and that's really a shame. And that brings you back to Elon Musk as a key figure. I would also right now want to include Peter Beck in that at Rocket Lab. He has reshaped the small sat market, rocket launch market, fundamentally, and he's now not afraid to then take a next step and try to do reusable first stages like Musk. He's trying to do the same kind of thing, and he's not afraid. Yeah, so it sounds like he's copying Musk, but you know what? He's not. He's coming up with his own way of doing it that makes sense for his rocket. But he's done the same kind of thing, and he's capturing the part of the market that SpaceX is not ideally placed for right now, which is the small sat market that's growing, that's going to dominate the commercial satellite field in the next couple of decades.
Well, how do you feel? I see articles all the time where SpaceX is going to give that launcher market a real run for the money because of rideshare.
Well, yes, SpaceX is going to give them a run because SpaceX knows how to compete. There's no question of that. But the disadvantage of a bigger rocket on that rideshare system is that if you've got a small sat that needs to go to a particular place in a particular orbit, if you're coming in either as a secondary payload or as a cluster of many payloads from many different customers, you're not going to get your choice.
You have to improvise.
And what these small sat rocket companies are providing is that kind of flexibility. And that doesn't mean SpaceX is not going to give them a run for the money. It means, look, SpaceX has demonstrated how small sats should run on a big rocket with its Starlink. You got a constellation you need to launch, you should probably talk to SpaceX because you may get it all launched on one launch. But if you have you have smaller satellites that have specific needs and the numbers aren't that great, and you, because of cash flow or development reasons, you can't do them all at once, you got to do them over a period of time, then going to a smaller rocket that can launch where you need them makes more sense. And so there's room for both. And the fact is that Pat Beck with Rocket Lab has helped transform the industry, capturing that, providing a need for the small sats. And what that is, where that is affecting SpaceX is it's cutting down on the larger satellites. They're not being made as much. And what that means is there's not enough business for the bigger rockets. SpaceX's advantage is because their rockets are so cheap because of the reusability, they're essentially just grabbing the entire market more and more. And I'll be talking about that when I do my annual worldwide launch report at the end of the year. And so those are transformable individuals. They really have made a difference. And the thing that makes them unique is actually, I wrote about this recently after after SpaceX's Starship 40,000-foot test flight. This is an old-fashioned American attitude where you keep an open mind, you're willing to jump and change on a moment's notice, you're flexible. You're fearless. That's the really important part of the American dream that is dying. You're fearless. You take chances. You do things that are risky because the payoff will be so great. And you're willing to take the chance that you'll fail. And SpaceX's Starship was a wonderful example of that. Because, you know, they're not only willing to risk failure, but they're willing to broadcast that failure to the entire world live, you know. And so Peter Beck and Elon Musk demonstrate that kind of attitude. And that's how you succeed. And that's how private enterprise succeeds, with that kind of competitive approach. Today, for example, Astra had became the second small sat rocket company to actually get a payload into orbital space. They were just short of having enough payload, enough velocity to get into orbit, just short. But they got it. Everything worked. They just didn't have quite enough velocity. And according to the company, the only issue is they can change their fuel mixtures to give them a little bit more oomph. And so their next test flight, the third of their rocket, they're not going to change any software. They're not going to change any hardware. They're just going to change the fuel mix. They expect to make orbit. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, no, I have a listener question I want to ask.
All right.
You.
Well, so anyway, this is the transformable thing that's really amazing, and it's really exciting. And the future is bright if we just let people have the freedom to do what they want to do. So call this question.
Ben is in Denver, and he says, in mentioning Blue Origin, this was several minutes ago, he said New Shepard has gone dark. Is this still a project? Do you know anything about it?
That's a good, very good question. New Shepard apparently gone dark in many ways. I mean, they were supposed to be doing lots and lots of launches. They've got their third prototype, I think, has flown.
Uh-huh.
And it's been successful. But their pace of launches has ground to a real slow pace in the last 2 years. And they keep promising more flights, but they don't do it. And the only thing I can think of is that the success of SpaceX with the Dragon has had Blue Origin rethink its suborbital tourism business. And instead thinking orbital instead, except their New Glenn rocket just hasn't been going very far. And I think the problem there is that their BE-4 engine had technical problems that it apparently ULA solved finally. But so if New Glenn flies, then there's an orbital tourism market they can make and make more money. That's the only thing I can think of. Why the thing is slow to a stop, I do not know. They have done a few flights. It's almost like they're doing these, they're limiting the flights to those they can make some money on with scientific payloads.
Maybe they don't want to get into a competition with Virgin Galactic. I don't know.
Well, my attitude would be they're so much far. They have so much better a engineered craft than Virgin Galactic. They shouldn't be running away. They should be going full steam ahead because they would probably grab the market share because the Virgin Galactic has enormous problems. I mean, they just tried to do their first flight, Virgin Galactic, out of their New Mexico spaceport.
Right.
And they took off. Unity separated. That's the Spaceship Two name of their second craft. It separated. They fired its engine, and those engines immediately shut down. And they had to glide to the ground. It was a fizzle. And they say there were issues involved. But, you know, this is a company that's been trying to do this now for nigh on 16 years.
Well, when was the XPRIZE one? It was, what, 2004, something like that?
Yeah, so right after Spaceship 2, Spaceship 1, they announced that was when the project was started.
So,
now, I got to think about this for a minute. The number of test flights, actual test flights to space, that Blue Origin's New Shepard has done, I think at this moment in time exceeds what Unity has done. And so they have a better, Blue Origin has a more well-tested spacecraft that functions more reliably. And so why they aren't trying to grab that market right now, I don't know. It could be that the number of, the amount of interest in flying on the craft is not that great. And in Blue Origin, it's a closed corporation. It's a closed company. There's no stock involved. And so they could look at the amount, the interest level from people who, you know, can email them. And they might have gauged it and said, you know, there's not going to be that much customers at this moment in time, especially with the orbital opportunity coming. And so they might be backing off for that reason. Virgin Galactic has become a public stock in the last 2 years, and so they have a different game going on there, and Richard Branson is part of it. Richard Branson, very conveniently this year, when the stock went up, sold off his majority holdings. He's no longer running that company. And in fact, he sold off a great deal more of it in the last 2 months when the price was high probably to shore up Virgin Airlines, which is dying because of the epidemic. But nonetheless, he has gotten out, and he's gotten out at a significant stock profit. And so Virgin Galactic has, for its stockholders, an incentive, especially the ones that want to sell, an incentive to have successful operations of some kind so that the stock will rise.
Well, they got incredible backing from Morgan Stanley and other houses. They're predicting a $26 a share price.
They did. And then what they did is that to my mind, that demonstrated to me the bankrupt and maybe corrupt nature of a lot of the stock advisors in Wall Street. Because I read some of those reports, and I say, these people don't know anything about Virgin Galactic to make these, and the technology involved, to make these kind of recommendations. What they did do with those recommendations is convince a lot of stock players, investors,
it's a hot
to put
number.
Money in it, and who didn't know anything.
It's a hot number. I wish I had bought it. Yeah, and you would have risen 10 points when I started paying attention to it.
Yeah, well, it went up to over 30. It's now dropped to below 24, about 24, because of the fizzled flight.
Right.
But you know what? When it was high, guess who was selling his stock? Richard Branson.
Mr. Branson.
So I have no idea how or why those stock investment companies made those recommendations, but they were very conveniently timed to help Richard Branson sell off his stock when he needed to the most.
Well,
that I find the timing there is very interesting.
Well, I don't have any access to them. I would love to see their recommendations on Virgin Galactic. If any listeners have it, if you get Morgan Stanley reports or the other reports that are really bullish on Virgin, send them to me. I'd love to read them or scan them or email them or something. I think it'd be really interesting to see how they do it. But I do know evaluating stocks like Tesla, for example, and others is very different today than it was 30, 40 years ago. So it's a different world.
Well, you know what? The stock market is always a game where if you're inside the market, they can make any rules they want about insider trading type stuff. Games like that can always go on. There's no way to really prevent it, even with the law. And so, you know, it's a dangerous place to play unless you really know what's going on, because they can play games. And everything about Virgin Galactic strikes me as a lot of games playing, because the company doesn't deserve the stock rise that it's gotten, not even close.
Well,
whether they eventually achieve orbital flight with customers, that might happen. I want them to succeed, I'll be honest. I do want that to happen, but I am very suspicious of that company and the state of its engineering especially. I would not. They need to do a lot more test flights before they should allow customers on there.
Well, I tend to believe that if the value is there and people are buying it and they're getting recommendations, there's something there, regardless of what I may understand or not understand, because I'm not connected with it at all. So I'd probably give them the benefit of doubt until proven otherwise that there's some reason there. I once, a couple of weeks ago, questioned how Tesla could be worth so much, and I didn't see it. And a lot of listeners sent me information on Tesla and why, in their opinion, Tesla was absolutely worth its nearly at the time $1,000 share price. So there's probably a good economic reasoning for Virgin Galactic to be where it is, and I don't follow it, so I can't tell you.
Oh, my sense is that there is I have been skeptical of Tesla as well, but there is one difference between Tesla and Virgin Galactic. Tesla has been around a much shorter time and has been actually selling product to customers now for, what, 5 years?
Yeah,
actual
probably,
cars selling
probably,
to customers?
Probably more than that.
Yeah, and Virgin Galactic's been around for 16 years and has yet to sell a single ticket to a customer. And even at this point with
They've sold tickets to customers. They haven't made any of their flights
They've
yet.
Taken deposits from customers. That's not the same thing.
Well, they have a contract on those.
Exactly,
seats.
True, but they haven't flown anybody.
Yeah, they haven't flown yet.
They haven't sold a single customer.
But
they haven't delivered once their product.
It's probably a lot harder than building an electric car.
That might be so, but then again, think about SpaceX, the other half of Elon Musk's empire, or at least part of his empire. They started building the Falcon 9 rocket in around 07 or so, 08. And they were flying it by 09, and they were doing commercial launches by, about 08, 09.
Well,
and they ramped up to full speed by 16. This is a big difference between Virgin Galactic.
Different people, different game plans, different financing.
Talents.
I don't know that it's
better
it's
management
comparable.
Plans, maybe better engineering.
I also think the market, this is my own opinion, the market for orbital is a better market than suborbital, even though it's a lot more expensive.
There's truth to that, too. Yeah, that could be one of the reasons Blue Origin is shifting away from New Shepard. That's absolutely the case. I mean, that's truly possible. You know, there are a lot of reasons why Virgin Galactic is questionable in my mind. For one thing, for example, its design, it's a dead end. It can only do suborbital launches.
Well, but meanwhile,
at least Blue Origin, in developing its vertical landing, New Shepard, was developing technology they can scale up to their orbital craft. And that's something that's not a dead end.
Well, I'd love to do another show with Virgin. I've sent notes to George and others over the years, and I've not gotten a response. Maybe I'll try again for next year. You have a caller. Let's see who your caller is.
Oh, okay.
Hold on. Hi, caller. Thank you for calling. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall in my usual location.
Okay.
Hi, Marshall.
Hello. And one of the things I noticed what you were talking about is the competitiveness. And last night I watched a program on Carol Shelby, who did the Cobra Car and then did the Viper for Chrysler, and then the Shelby Mustang. And you kind of step back and look at this history, and you kind of go, wait a minute. The key thing he always needed was to get everybody else out of his way.
Did you watch what, Ford versus Ferrari?
Yeah. That's basically what it was about.
When you say get people out of his way, explain exactly what you mean in that. Is this within the companies he was working? He was always getting resistance.
Well, he made a partnership with Ford, and every time the Ford engineers kind of jumped on his case and said, do it this way because we need the money, et cetera, et cetera, we need the glory, they lost. And whenever he came in there and, you know, made the special cars, they won. They went out and beat Ferrari back in the 60s. And then even after he was out of the car business for a while, he knew how to go out and sell new products. They made a claim that he started the chili cook-offs because he had 1,000 acres of junk land and he couldn't figure out anything else to do, so he threw a party.
He got killed driving, too, so.
Well,
it comes with the turf, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well,
interesting, Marshall. So what's your question in relation to that?
The real question is, how do we get the government to let people go out and make the risks and do exactly what Elon does? He just comes in there and goes, let's do it this way, let's do it that way. Oh, it failed. Fix it. Move. That's exactly how we succeeded in the Apollo programs.
Well, they let Musk do it, and Musk has done it, so the government obviously is willing to do that. Musk accomplished that.
I've kind of got the feeling Musk accomplished it despite the government.
Well,
I would say, David, that Marshall in this case is correct, that Musk, the reason Musk succeeded in this way, where others who were trying to do the same thing, like the guys doing the Conestoga rocket back in the late 80s, 90s, failed. The reason they failed is that Musk had, from the beginning, a very, very, very deep pocket. And so he was a little bit insulated from the pressures.
He had more independence.
He was independent. He could go ahead and do what he thought he needed to do. And when the big players in the government or in the big companies, like the big space companies, would try to squelch him, and they surely did, he could rearrange what he was doing freely with the money he had to get away from that pressure and continue to do what he was doing, such as he'd stop depending on subcontractors that will, in some cases, literally sabotaging him, and instead do it in-house.
And
the result was that he eventually was free from them. So his deep pockets gave him some freedom to operate. Having done that, and establishing the precedent, it's a precedent that was the norm prior to World War II, but the precedent that a private company can do it better, it has made it easier for other private companies later to have the freedom to act and get less resistance. It has helped other companies. But the key here is that you're asking, how can we get the government to leave people alone? The government we are a country, a democracy. The government's going to be what we choose it to be. And if the American people are choosing to have a government that is, rule the nest, to tell people the best way to do things because it thinks it knows best, then that's what we're going to get, and there's no way around that. That's what we're going to get. And so you want to stop the government from being invasive and oppressive, then you have to choose a different government. For the last 50 years with the space shuttle and NASA, the American people, and I was included in this, thought that what we needed was a well-financed space program run by NASA. So they were totally, everyone was totally sanguine with the idea of NASA restricting all private launches when the shuttle was made and just having them done by the space shuttle. So literally the American launch industry was literally destroyed at that moment in time because all launches had to go through NASA. And the public was totally agreeable to that. That's what the government people wanted. And so you ask, we are government, we are a society of government, you know, we are a democracy, a republican democracy. If the public wants a free society or a free, more important, a free, open space industry that does what the industry people think is the best thing, then you have to support that in your government.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to agree that I think you're absolutely right, even though I refuse to feel like I'm responsible or have any part in holding everybody back.
Well, the more that Musk is successful, the more he is a pathfinder for the future, and it's harder and harder for any group or any organization or any government to probably try to rein that in unless they really aren't interested in the private sector. So Musk has been a wonderful addition to so many parts of developing space and space exploration and commercial space, and it will eventually pay off with human spaceflight. And he is a trailblazer, and we have a lot, in my opinion, to thank him for taking a risk and deciding that this is what he wanted to do with his money and with his time and his energy. And I hope it continues. He's a young guy. Well, he's younger than me. And I hope his health is good, and I hope he is going to be around to fight these battles because they're not going to go away. You know, and he's going to be in the hot seat for years to come, and commercial space, space exploration, human space flight, in my opinion, really needs him. For those that really want to go to Mars, we really need Musk, even if he's not the one that goes. For those of us that want space settlement, I think you need somebody carrying the torch, and Musk, with what he's doing and his innovation, I think is that guy. I don't want to sit here and like be a kiss ass to Elon Musk, but I think he is that important to the industry, and the more regulatory an environment we find ourselves into, the more important characters like Musk are.
Mm-hmm. We also come in there, and you're never kissing ass whenever you are pointing to the fact that he is lowering the cost of getting to space.
So,
that you're just pointing out a truth.
Well, I'm really interested, and maybe others have seen it, and I've not seen it. But as you know, there seems to be a shift going toward people saying the Green New Deal can apply to space. I'm not taking a position on that one way or another. I have my biases, but I'm really anxious to see how Musk and SpaceX move their companies amidst the pressure of a Green New Deal with space. And I don't have a clue what that's going to look like, but I'm really interested to see how Musk responds to that pressure that's going to be forthcoming.
Most of the Green New Deal's design has nothing to do with environmental causes. The design of the new Green Deal, if you actually read it, is to establish a Marxist government in the United States.
Yeah, but they're going to shift.
The point I'm bringing, raising that point, Dave, is just to point out that Musk is going to be fighting powers that wish power, and so he's going to have to be fighting on a power basis against those.
Well, and also for the use against fossil fuels and other things, which his rockets require.
Yeah.
I don't see how he can launch a rocket with green energy. I really don't. But maybe he'll innovate, and maybe he will. I just don't know.
I mean, if the Green New Deal gets imposed, then we go back to a dark age, because no energy source that we have presently pretty much can provide the energy we need for doing something as simple as use our smartphones. So anyone who uses a smartphone to push the Green New Deal is not realizing
that. Let me tell you.
Anyway, the point I'm getting at is that applies to space as well, because you can't launch rockets without using
fossil fuels.
You can't.
Given that I live in the current champion location of the power outages and power blackout, I am here to tell everyone firsthand that you may have a little bit of power, that's a brownout, but you may have a blackout, but if the cell towers near you have gone dark, you have no cell phone.
Yeah.
You have no email if you have a smartphone. You have no text messaging. You don't got bookus. And even if your battery is charged, maybe you charged it in your car, you got nothing until energy can get back to those cell towers. So when we were having the big power outages a year ago, not this past year, but before, Verizon and AT&T put in mobile cell towers on trucks that they could keep charged independently of the grid, so that their cell phone users would not be, you know, cut out, because many people only have a cell phone. That's their only link in an emergency to anything. And you could go around, and I could see them in parts of Sonoma County and Marin County, trucks with that were supporting huge amounts of equipment to, you know, maintain at least some kind of plausible cell coverage.
I should point out, David, that one, that is a much less green solution.
Horrible.
Versus using hydroelectric and the grid to power these things.
I don't think they were caring about green at the time.
Yeah, but one of the reasons there is power outages like that is because of the hostility to fossil fuels, and there's no way anything in our society can be accomplished without
them.
So what's Musk, let's get stay focused on space. How is Musk going to have to deal with possibilities of regulatory
control? I don't know. I'm anxious to see, because I think it's coming his way.
He is very good. David, just say, let me just point out, he has played this game brilliantly over the last 20 years. It's really been astonishing how well he's played the game so that he's gotten the government on his side. And sometimes he's pushed them. Sometimes he's petted them. You know, he's taken any track that he thinks is going to work to get them on his side. And with Dragon, it's a great example. NASA was hostile to him from the start. They thought Boeing was the cat's meow. And, of course, it's now completely the opposite. NASA right now in its management is pretty disgusted with Boeing, is my impression, and not have much faith in Boeing. One of the reasons they delayed Starliner. So, and what he, Trump, what I'm sorry, what Musk just recently, there was a recent story I posted on Behind the Black, where Indonesia called Trump and said, we'd like you to set up a spaceport in our country. And he's going to send a team out there to look at the possibilities. And there's a lot of complications having to do with ITAR and other things for him to do it. But just threatening to do it puts pressure on the government to not push him too hard.
Well,
I think it's a game. He's playing it well.
The other thing I think that Musk is going to be challenged about, and Marshall, do you have anything more, or I'll clear the line?
I seem to have gotten things off to a rousing fun start here, so I'll let you guys take over.
Thanks, Marshall. Bye-bye. I think Musk is going to come head on, maybe not in 2021, but as he gets closer to the reality of flights to Mars with people, I think he's going to come head on into planetary protection.
I agree with you.
And this, I'm going to sit back. I mean, I want him to win big time, okay? I mean, I'm making no bones about my biases here. I'm on Bob Zubrin's side. I'm on Musk's side of this. But I'm going to, I just hope I'm still around and I can see this, because I want to see this play out. And I want to see how Musk, who I think can be a really great chess player and brilliant strategist, how he deals with it. He's got to know it's coming, and he's got to be thinking about strategies for it.
Yeah, it's been pretty clear for the last decade that the whole planetary protection faction within the political academic community, its real purpose is not to protect the planet.
Well, it's not to go there.
Squelch space exploration, or at least any space exploration that that faction did not approve of. It's a power game. It's always a power game. And so they've now escalated planetary protection to not just simply preventing, you know, microbes from getting to Earth or contaminating planets with microbes before we can study them properly, but now it's to a point where the pristine nature of these planets must not be changed or warped in any way, shape, or form, which, of course, is absurd. And it's once again taking us to a dark age, and we can't have it.
Well,
we'll see if we can fight. It all depends on how much power the government has and where it wants to go. If the government gets to a point where it's got so much power, it doesn't matter what games Musk plays. Then it doesn't matter, and at that point they'll shut it down.
Well, there are people who genuinely believe in the planetary protection cause,
sure,
and I'm not dismissing them, but we'll see what happens. And I know you want to take a break. We're a little bit about halfway, so listeners, I'm gonna pause for my sponsor messages, take a quick break. We'd love to have more of your phone calls than only Marshall calling tonight, so the phone number is 866-687-7223. I will answer the phone if you call while I'm doing sponsor messages and just put you on hold until we come back in a couple of minutes. And Bob will be back in a couple of minutes. So, listeners, we do have sponsors, and they absolutely play a fundamental role in supporting the space show. And since we're coming into 2021, we have room for a couple of new sponsors. So right now, Northrop Grumman is with us, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. So Northrop Grumman, of course, is an absolutely incredible leading global security company. They've got technology going from undersea to outer space, cyberspace, commercial and government customers. We're going to be doing some Northrop Grumman programming. I think it's going to be pretty early in the year, so we're working on that right now. The Space Foundation, great new programming, and their symposium, hopefully they'll be able to do it, is Colorado Springs, but in August. You'll get information about that at spacesymposium.org. But they have this new program I've been telling you about. You go to the spacefoundation.org website for Space Symposium 365. It's a new all-online, all-digital platform, delivers amazing content for the space community. I've been getting their messages. You can sign up for them and attend them virtually. And, wow, very, very cool, very high quality. Astrox is our friend A.J. Kothari, and, boy, is he going wild with Howard Bloom. I introduced him to Howard. And, boy, has he found a venue. But he does a lot of hypersonic work, and he's coming back on the program on December 22nd to talk about what he's doing and some of his moon ideas. And if you're reading his post on Howard Bloom, he's been saying an awful lot about China and the China space program and national security, and he's not repeating the same mantras as everybody else. So Astrox, great company, and AJ is very creative, and you want to hear his show on December 22nd. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, you can join it. You don't have to be a member. I mean, you don't have to be an engineer. The largest professional engineering organization around, and they are still all virtual, but they have lots of great programming that you can join. Hopefully they'll go back to conferences. They have that amazing peer-reviewed library that you've heard me talk about. You can get a lot more information by going to AIAA.org. Moonwards, you want to tune in on Sunday when John and I bring Kim back on. This is John Jossie, Fremont John, for the new and upgraded Moonwords, and hopefully the demo will be on the blog before the show, and you can try it out and tell us what you think. So this is a demo of the town and what you can do in it, and it's going to be really, really cool. So I'm changing Kim's message a little bit, so you definitely want to tune in on Sunday. Celestis is still the company if you want to do a memorial spaceflight with a loved one or friend's DNA, or if you're cremating and you have a little bit of ashes to spare, you can do that. You can add your DNA to go with your loved one. You can do orbital, you can do suborbital, and you can do a lunar flight. And you get a lot more information by going to Celestis.com. And, you know, I'm a customer of Celestis, so I think very highly of them. And Mom and my dogs are going to the moon on their lunar flight, which is probably toward the end of 2021. The National Space Society sponsors it. They do ISDC. It's scheduled for around the end of May, June in Los Angeles. I'm hoping it happens. Los Angeles is a tough place with the virus right now. They also do space settlement workshops and white papers on space solar power. Great organization, also a nonprofit. Check them out at space.nss.org. And then the Integrated Space Plan. This is the development chart showing the path to how to become a space-faring race. The technologies and destinations overlap with each other. And if you're looking at the virtual one, it expands, and there's lots and lots of options. But you can buy a copy and hang it on the wall or in a frame. It's very intuitive. It's also instructional. If you have small kids, it's very impressive and inspiring. So check that out at thespaceplan.com. If you want to be a sponsor, remember your messages are also on all the archive programs, and many of our archives from back in 2001 are still being played. That's when we started the program. So your message and your company imprint or whatever it is that you want to promote, it lasts as close to being forever as possible. So if you're interested in becoming a sponsor, we have a great program to help you do that. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Bob, are you back with
us? Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so listeners, once again, we'd love to hear from you via the telephone, 1-866-687-7223. The line is available, and email continues to be drspace@thespaceshow.com. Any word on who might be considered for the next NASA administrator?
Oh, no, this is much too early. In the last few transitions between different presidents, it took more than almost a year plus to replace the administrator. When Dan Golden left, it was a year before a new one came in after the Clinton administration. Then when Obama took over, it was more than a year before Bolden took over. And then after when Trump took power, it was more than a year before Brinenstein was finally chosen. And so I would not expect this change. You're going to have an acting administrator for a long period of time if Biden...
Who is it going to be?
Acting is probably going to be... You know, I don't know the name, but it's going to probably see some guy in the management of NASA that's been there for a long time.
Like a deputy administrator.
Yeah, exactly. Like Bowersock, not Bowersock, in fact, I'm blanking on the guy's name, who was doing it between Bolden and the Brinenstein. It'll be something like that, and it's a placeholder person usually is what happens, because these are always political plums within the political community, payoffs for people who have supported the candidate, and therefore they give them the job.
You have another caller.
Sure, let's have another call.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there, John.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Well, there is one green solution for getting to orbit. That's like the Delta IV hydrogen oxygen rocket. It's
true. You got a good point there. I mean, that's essentially what the space shuttle did as well. But the problem from a commercial point of view is the difficulty of storing the hydrogen makes it very expensive. And that's one of the reasons the private companies have not chosen to use it, because of the cost of storing and fueling the rocket. That's my understanding. I'm not an engineer, but it makes sense to me too. And so even though that is a green solution, if it's imposed on the commercial market, it could seriously crimp the commercial the customer base, because suddenly they will not be able to afford to do what they've been doing for now with the cheaper fossil fuels alternatives.
But another problem with that, of course, is it's bulky, and that's not the best thing for first stage. First stage, you want more momentum thrust than just specific impulse. That's another. Which is what had SRBs on the
table. You speak as an educated engineer more than me, and I try. Yeah. I accept your point totally.
But
what I've heard, but I'm not an engineer, so it never comes to mind as exactly as you said it.
But then again, the thing is that. From Musk's point of view, of course, he has a political lever, and that is he's Mr. Electric Car. So they like that. So maybe, you know, it's a bit of a trade-off, and he has gone to methane, which is a little bit less CO2 intensive.
Yes.
So maybe he can wrangle a political deal with them if they get that powerful.
I have a question. I probably shouldn't raise it. But, you know, it really troubles me because I see the industry going to electric cars. And I see charging stations all over the place, and some of them, you don't even pay to charge your car. I guess the government's supporting it somehow, or the city is supporting it, or the shopping center is supporting it. Because, I've looked at it. There's Tesla chargers, and then there's everybody else's chargers. The problem that I have, and I would really like an objective, factual response, not an ideological one, but that electricity is being generated somehow. It's not coming out of the clear blue. So how are they making the electricity? Is it coming from nuclear, fossil fuels, hydro, solar power? Is it coming from windmills? Where is it coming from?
I can give you an answer, though. Some people have been accused of being
ideological. I know an answer, too, but it just seems to me that we're just trading one source of fossil fuels for another.
You're absolutely right.
And I don't get it. Look, California, I hate to use it as an example because it's an aberration right now for the 49 other states. But the reason we go to brownouts on a hot day is because of this mandate that you have to have like 25 or 30% renewables. So the renewables start to shut down in the evening, because the sun goes down, the wind is BS, it's not there. And they could buy power, fossil fuel, or nuclear, which California is shutting down and getting away from, on the spot market, but it's really costly to buy power on the spot market. So the plant administrator for the state of California doesn't want to buy spot power. Therefore, shut down. And they look at where the energy usage is coming from, shut them down, brown them out, rotate them, and let's see if we can't get through until 10 o'clock at night when the demand maybe comes back in line with what can come from the grid. This is a management issue and an economic issue where they don't have enough fossil fuels to keep the power going on really hot days, and they don't want to buy power on the spot market, and the green energy isn't there.
You know, David, you say you don't want an ideological response, but the trouble is
that's factual.
Let me try to answer your question to a certain extent. The reason that you have these problems, and the reason no one wants to look at the elephant in the room when it comes to electric cars is because of ideology. They are not choosing electric cars based on a rational look at the cost benefit for the environment and for energy, making that choice. They are making the choice based on an ideological belief system that somehow electric cars will reduce the amount of fossil fuel use. And it's not a rational look at the data. It just isn't. Wind is a great example of that. Back in 2000, the vice president, Dick Cheney, said, there is no reason to subsidize wind power because no matter how much we subsidize it, at the best it's going to do, it's now 3% of our power needs. The best it can do is maybe double in 20 years to 6%. It can't serve our needs. He said that in 20, and he was pillared. He was attacked. But he was just looking at the actual data. And the same thing here with electric cars. They must pull their power out of the grid. The grid is created from a number of sources, most of which are fossil fuel-based. The only one that isn't would be hydroelectric.
Well, nuclear.
But nuclear has its own problems environmentally. There's hostility to it. And so the result is that you are, in the end, increasing fossil fuel no matter what. If you look at it rationally. Then, of course, no one wants to look at the environmental cost of building the batteries. There is environmental cost in getting the materials. Some of them are rare earth minerals. And the actual construction has environmental costs. And it's high-intensive energy costs to do it. And so you have to, the argument I'm making here is not against green environmental protection. It's an argument that if you want to protect the environment, you have to look for the most rational, cost-effective approach to providing the American public and the customers the energy they want and need. And you have to work from that basis. If you do that, you can then start to analyze the best way to produce the energy without damaging the environment. But you've got to work from the basis, the most efficient, practical way to do it, and eliminate choices that don't make sense. But you see, you raised some points, David. If you try to raise these points, and I brought up Cheney as an example, you get attacked. You're not allowed to say these things. This is the mental state the nation has reached now, where you cannot discuss this stuff rationally with people.
Well,
they are too emotionally tied to their ideology.
If we had an increase in electric car usage, and I forget how much it is, it would crash the grid in California.
Oh, yeah, this has been discussed at great length. Analysis of the number of cars needed
to crash the grid.
Once you have a lot of electric cars on the market, you're suddenly going to get to a point where the grid
You're going to tank the grid.
That's been documented a number of times.
So we're not there
real
yet.
Real good research,
but
no one wants to listen.
But
Elon Musk was just saying that today, I think, right? I heard that he was complaining that going to electric vehicles over the next 20 years, there's not near enough electric capacity.
One thing about him is he might be trying to build an electric car, but he also is, that's what makes his company so successful. He is coldly, intellectually honest, and if he sees an issue that's going to make a problem for his product, he's going to talk about it. And that's part of the issue. And this relates to space in that same thing. If you want to have a space program, if you want to have Starlink to provide rural internet capabilities, you're going to have a launch industry. You're going to have a launch industry. You know, do you want to have internet capabilities in every spot on the world?
If you want that, then
you have to face the reality that this might be the way to do it.
I'm hearing proposals out there for electric rockets, and I'm sitting here thinking, maybe 20 years from now, there'll be electric rockets. I don't know.
You can't.
How can there be an electric rocket?
Gavin Newsom, your governor in California, declaring that in 2035 there will be no more fossil fuel cars, period. And that's by fiat. Well, you know, same thing. Let's have an electric rocket. You got to have the engineering. You can't, by decree, make such things happen.
Well, in 20 years, could there be an electric rocket?
Gone? Do you think so?
Could you have an electric rocket that could do the power
from Earth's surface?
Yeah, they want. I've heard and read articles about putting the Green New Deal into the space community, and one way to do that is to have electric rockets for the launchers rather than what we're using now. And I'm scratching. Thank God I still have a bunch of hair on my head.
Maybe beamed energy in the sense that they've played around with that idea. I mean, you know, where you, I guess they could generate it electric initial source. But
where does the electric come from?
Well, maybe
from my nuclear reactor. No, just kidding. I had to say. I was thinking what Elon could be gaming. Then he's going to argue for space solar, and of course he'd provide the launch capability to support.
Correct.
Him.
Yeah, obviously.
Of course.
Maybe that's where he's playing at. He makes the first move of saying, now there's a problem.
Well,
and they propose a solution later.
I'll put it in the hands of the listeners. If any of you have real information on green rockets and how they would work and where they get their energy from and how we supply that energy, post it on the blog. Or if you're really adept at it, I'll put you on the show and do a space show program about it, because I'm hearing more and more about this sort of stuff, and I'm truly baffled. I'm puzzled. I don't see it. I don't understand it, and maybe some of you out there do.
I will tell you that when I hear proposals like that, similar to Gavin Newsom declaring there'll be no cause, possibly cause in 2035, electric rockets, it's usually coming from someone who really does not know much about the engineering or the actual technology involved with achieving what they're advocating. And in this case, this is once again getting back to looking for the most cost-effective approach to achieving what you want, because invariably the most cost-effective way to do something, which is what capitalism encourages and competition encourages, is going to probably be the least damaging both to the environment and to the public and to everybody, because it's going to have few negative consequences because of the cost involved with those. And if they do have negative costs, like, for example, a chemical company dumping its chemicals, its waste in an ocean, in a river, then you do bring the government to stop such things. But if you eliminate the chemical company entirely instead of having them have waste management, then you therefore prevent the chemicals from being made. And the same thing with rockets. If you're going to come up with a pie-in-the-sky technology that you don't know how it can be built, then you'll end up squelching the entire industry.
Well, it'd be fun to watch it all happen. John, do you have anything additional you want to add?
Well, on the chemicals, you know, they said there was this one guy who had a petition out and said, should we ban dihydrogen oxide?
Oh, yes. I've seen that petition.
Everybody was signing it. But
yes,
anyway.
I wonder if the readers and the listeners know the evils of dioxygen hydrogen. And why it contributes to deaths everywhere in the country at all times. We should ban it. And all that is, it's a joke petition, because all that is another way of saying H2O water. And I, my oldest nephew, when he was about 15, handed me a copy of that petition and said, what do you think of this? And I didn't look at it closely, but started to read it, and I started to argue, well, I don't trust these kind of petitions as a general rule, because they're usually political in nature.
I've never seen
it. I didn't realize it was H2O at first.
I've never seen it. But,
it's actually pretty hysterical. In fact, I have it right on my desk here. Here it is. Ban dihydrogen monoxide. This is the actual piece of paper he gave me maybe 25 years ago. Contamination is reaching epic proportions. It is a major component of acid rain, contributes to greenhouse effect, may cause severe burns, contributes to the erosion of natural landscape, accelerates corrosion and rusting in many metals, may cause electrical failures and decreased effectiveness of automobile brakes, has been found in excised tumors of terminal cancer patients. And then it points out how it's an industrial solvent and coolant. It's used in nuclear power plants.
Do they tell you it's water?
It's styrofoam. It's as a fire retardant. And, you know, this is the horror must be stopped.
Do they tell you it's water?
No, not in this piece of paper. No, that's the whole point. The joke is you get people to agree, and only after they've agreed do you then point that out to them, but not in the paper, because you don't want them to realize that they've been – That's what they've done. Ban DHMO, dihydrogen monoxide. But, you know, humor has truth. And the reason this petition is actually believed by people, I've actually seen YouTube videos where they've gone to college campuses and gotten people to sign this, is because people today are quick, knee-jerk, willing to listen to those kind of pie-in-the-sky demands without really thinking about the actual needs and the technology and what you need to do. And that gets back to electric rockets. I mean, it sounds like a great idea, but, you know, it's got to be profitable and it's got to make sense. and it's got to do the job.
There's actually a website for this, and it's current. Ban DHMO. The United States will not weaponize DHMO as long as I am president. You have my solemn word on this. Beware of conservative Republicans, though. Some of them are pro-clean DHMO. President Barack Obama, Washington, D.C., January 2010. The invisible killer, DHMO, is colorless, tasteless, and, I mean, it's a real website.
Yeah, and the truth here is that it's just an example of the kind of stuff you see. And once again,
so they're serious.
Declaring that you're going to have no cars by 2035 or that you're going to have electric rockets without really the engineering existing is the same kind of thing. It's not thinking out the details. And so you're asking about electric power and cars, and that's the simple fact is it's not ideological to raise the questions about the alternative power sources. Are they going to be good? But it is ideological to demand them without thinking about those actual engineering questions. And that's where we are. It's the ideology of demanding it without really knowing the reality
here,
of the thing.
I just looked up, is DHMO the same as H2O? What does dihydrogen monoxide mean? Dihydrogen monoxide is technically correct,
yes,
though rarely used chemical name for water.
Yeah.
It has been employed as a hoax to evoke fear in the minds of people who are scientifically uninformed.
Yes, yes. I'm not going to go there. I could say evoking fear in people, but I'm not going to go there.
I was unaware of this completely. John, what's else on your mind? Otherwise, I'll clear the line.
Okay, well, I'll let somebody else
John, I can't resist it, so I don't want a long conversation. I just want to know if you saw it. Maybe we'll talk later. Did you see the report on unidentified aerial phenomena in the ocean moving 200 miles and so per hour and being tracked by the Navy off the Atlantic coast?
I heard something about it. I think they mentioned on Tucker tonight.
Well, that was one place, but it's now coming out when the F-18 pilots have taken pictures of them going in and out of the ocean on their cell phones.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if you knew anything about it. Because
I don't know. I know anything more than those reports. No, I don't know any details.
All right. Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
My resident Tic Tac follower is John that keeps us up on on that. I'm interested in Tic Tac, so I continue to follow it on the show. Listeners, you can call. There's still plenty of time. Robert will take your call, 1-866-687-7223. And we'd certainly like to hear from you. What do you think about space settlement in 2021? Do you see it really sort of taking off somehow? Is there a way it can take off?
Well, when you say you got to define what you mean, David, by space settlement. If you're talking about a permanent occupancy in space, to a certain extent, we've had this now for more than 20 years because there's been a continuous occupation in space, residency in space on ISS in those 20 years. You know, people have been in space now continuously for one-fifth of a century. Settlement being, colonies on other planets, we're not there yet. But I would say that there's hope that we will get there, especially with what Elon Musk's company is doing right now. But not just Musk, because the whole restructuring and shakeup in the rocket industry to produce cheaper rockets, not just from SpaceX, is going to reshape that and make that more possible. But that's what you really need. You need to have cheaper launch capabilities. The one thing that I think Elon Musk at this moment in time hasn't addressed, he might be aware of it, I would not put that past him to be aware of it, but the one thing he hasn't really addressed is that Starship is not an interplanetary spaceship. This is a problem that NASA makes with Orion, and with, there's a difference between an ascent-descent rocket or capsule and an interplanetary spaceship. And there's also a difference between those two things and a ship that will land on Mars. They're different things. They need to be engineered differently. And so while Starship can get a great payload into orbit, I don't think Starship, as it's being built now, is the interplanetary ship to get to Mars. It's conceivable that they could create the upper stage of Starship to be that vehicle. It might make more sense to put that vehicle inside its hold, its cargo hold, once that's designed. But we're very far away from actually having all the components necessary to get a colony to Mars, as Elon Musk wants. If he gets the cheap payload into orbit access with Starship, he beats most of the biggest problems. It makes it possible to put a Skylab into the bay. You build kind of like, the way they try to do modular homes to save money, build a home in a factory and it's delivered to the home site, and that's a cheaper way than building it by hand at the home site. And it's been argued for decades, but it hasn't really successfully happened. But in this case, you could have that. You could have basically the factory builds the interplanetary ship ready to go, puts it inside Starship, it launches, and then releases it. And I think that's a way to approach this. Once again, you could conceivably engineer a Starship so that the Starship itself is the interplanetary ship, but I think it's not as efficient. This is getting back to cost effectiveness. Starship's Raptor engines are designed, I think, for getting up and down from Earth orbit. They are not necessarily the ideal thing to use to get yourself to Mars and back. I'm not an engineer, so this, I'm sure engineers could argue with me, and they'd be more right than me. But he is building the ship to get us into space, but he's nowhere, hasn't started even looking at how to build the ship to get us to Mars, and hasn't started to think about the ship to land. A good example of that is with his contract with NASA to bring cargo to the moon with Starship. There's pictures of Starship on the moon, but that's not on the moon. They're so far away from that being practical.
You have another caller.
Okay. Anyway, let's go.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you, please?
Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Hey, Tim.
How's it going?
It's going good.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been listening to the part about your show about the and being crazy environmentalism. And I can tell you, it's pretty bad. Back when they had the whole cold fusion craze back in 1989, you got to see a peek inside the inner workings of some of these people's minds, and it is not pretty. You had people going, you had one person, I think, with Paul, the guy who wrote the book, The Population Bomb, essentially saying that, clean, cheap, abundant energy, that's the worst thing that can possibly happen. John Holdren, who would later be the environmental czar for the Obama administration, went and said outright, giving people clean, cheap, abundant energy is like giving a loaded gun to a monkey. This is what these people were saying.
Yeah, Tim, this is all of a piece. I mean, it's been a consistent pattern for many, many years. I remember back in the 60s, Paul Ehrlich is the guy with the population bomb. I purchased that book off of the internet, the paperback, about 2 years ago because I thought, I want to really read this. And if you read it, it's like there's no science here. There's no thoughtful science. And more important, even if he thought he was working off of good modeling and good science work, the fact is that every single prediction he made was false. Turned out false, which means his modeling and his science is garbage and it shouldn't be relied on. And that's been the pattern of most of this kind of thinking. If you look at the hard science and the engineering behind their proposals, it doesn't hold water. And once again, when I say that, that's not ideological. The idea, the concepts they have might be brilliant if you could achieve it engineering-wise, but they're not interested in the engineering and the practicality. They're interested in the ideology of the concept, and that's the difference. And there's a problem with that. And those in California are suffering right now from an ideological position on power that is not practical and does not really address the problem properly. And this is a problem that's spreading to many other parts of the country. And we have to, you know, I'm going to speak my mind, but a lot of people don't want to hear it. They just don't want to hear it anymore.
Tim, do you have anything else that you want to add?
Yes, I do. And he made a valid point about engineering and how how people seem to disregard it altogether, even though if anything, engineers should be on the forefront.
Yes.
Since this is a technical issue, I'll give you an example. The whole thing about an electric rocket. You can have a carbon neutral rocket. You could use either nuclear power or solar and wind energy, and they can actually extract CO2 from seawater. They can use electrolysis to break down the seawater into hydrogen and oxygen, and then they can mix the carbon dioxide they extract from the seawater, the hydrogen they get from electrolysis, and they can mass produce methane, and it's carbon neutral. All you're doing is taking CO2 that was in the atmosphere that was absorbed by the seawater, and then just reprocess it into methane that you then use to power a rocket, and it's not a big deal because there's only so much CO2 that water can absorb. Depending on the solvency of seawater.
In other words, it's possible to do it as a carbon neutral, but it's going to require doing some things engineering wise that ideologically make the advocates of green power uncomfortable, and so they don't support such a thing. Is that where you're going, Tim?
Yeah, kind of. That's where I'm going.
Is it renewable? It's renewable, though, correct?
It can be renewable. I mean, you can also do the same process with gasoline. I mean, instead of trying to mass produce all these electric cars and take all the old cars off the road, which has an energy price because they have to then manufacture all these cars,
yeah,
and they have to put in a new infrastructure, why can't they have a cheap green source of energy to produce synth fuel, which essentially they just synthesize gasoline.
You know, that's maybe possible, but once again, we have to be careful because the energy cost and the economic cost of developing a synthetic fuel, which, by the way, the Department of Energy was created by the Carter administration
to do that,
specifically achieve, and we are now almost 40 years later, and they have really not developed such a thing that's practical or economically viable. So you got to be careful. Yeah, that might sound good, but is it really economically a viable choice? And I'm not, you know, I think if it's economical, it's going to happen very quickly. Because if it's economical, there'll be people who want to buy it. But if it's not economical, you're going to have a hard time getting it built because you won't have the investment capital because nobody sees it as a product that can make money. And a lot of these ideas may sound good, but they are on the fringe of the technology that's practical. That's always my fear when people make suggestions, Tim, like this.
Well, there's one thing I want to add as well. It's not just the technical issues involved in environmentalism. It's things like government regulations. They were actually killing a solar farm over some turtle that was out in the middle of the desert. That somehow these solar panels... Well, I mean, these solar farms were actually causing harm to these turtles.
You're right. There's another environmental cost for... I mentioned with the making of the batteries for the electric cars, there is environmental cost for every alternative, and you got to weigh the balance. For example, wind farms are incredibly harmful to bird life and bat life. Now, once again, maybe that's a cost that's worth paying if these things could really provide us cheap power. But the fact is that there's no evidence that they can. And so you're back to the same thing. What's the most efficient way to accomplish the task needed? And I don't think most of our policymakers in the American culture nowadays really think about that on the wider scale. They really don't.
Tim, anything? Anything else? Because I need to get going.
Oh, okay. I'll make this real quick. Well, I was actually approaching from a different. I was mentioning that for a different reason.
Yeah.
To show that a lot of the cost that goes into energy is these insane environmental regulation.
That's true.
That's really a lot of the cost goes right there. Something like mass-produced modular nuclear reactors would be pretty cheap. I think Thorcon was trying to get the thorium reactors to be cheaper than coal. At that point, something like syn fuel does become economically viable, especially now that you can just you can pump carbon dioxide and water and then out pops synthetic fuel, and you don't have to drill for it or anything like that. That can actually be economically viable and a rival to actually drilling for petroleum. But when you start adding in all the crazy regulations, not so much.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Tim.
All right.
Very good point.
Anything else?
All right, let you. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Tim.
No problem.
Bob, we're pretty much at the 90-minute point. What have we missed? Is there something?
Well, we haven't talked a lot about space. The first half hour or so, maybe first half of the show.
Well,
we spent a lot of time in the last half talking about environmental issues, which might impact space. We came up with SpaceX. So just in general, you know, this coming year. Is going to be, you know, I've said this for years, since the first day I appeared on your show back 20 years ago. Well, I shouldn't say that. Back about a decade ago when Obama canceled the Constellation project and it became SLS, I said we are entering a transition period between commercial and private enterprise and big government space. And we're pretty much out of that transition period right now. We are finally seeing the fruits of what private enterprise can do. And if we just recognize that and take a breath and let freedom rule, let liberty bell ring, then we have the sky's the limit.
Any predictions for 2021 for space? Keep it focused on space.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, that's where we're going to go. I mean, so SpaceX will start to be offering its Starlink constellation, starting to make money on that, and at the same time, they're going to be doing a lot of flights with Starship. And I predict that they will do an orbital launch next year. They will do it. That the pace is following that pattern very precisely. They will do an orbital launch. Whether they will land it, well, you know, I think they have a good shot at it. They based on their first test flight, they have a pretty good shot at being able to land Starship. And once again, they're not using here, a lot of the technology they're using is not super advanced. They are basically taking the knowledge gained from the space shuttle and other lifting body technology and applying it to Starship. And so that knowledge makes this not a it's cutting edge, but it's not a complete shot in the dark. And they're taking advantage of that knowledge to do it. They also have the knowledge to land a rocket vertically, and they have the knowledge in how to build something that can be reusable and viable and robust. So they're applying it now. So I have no doubt they're going to make orbit next year. I have no doubt at all. And the odds are high that they're going to make orbit before SLS finally flies.
Well, I was going to say real quick, SLS and James Webb for 2021.
Well, the Webb is still set for a March 21 launch, and it appears they're on schedule to do it. I think it's 2020. It's 21 in March, and that might have changed again, but I think that was the last time. I'd have to search my website. We don't have time. Right now, SLS is scheduled for late in 21, but there's a problem with the Orion capsule that might require as much as 4 months to a year to replace a part. I joked on John Batchelor about this, you know. Okay, you've got a light out in your dashboard. You take it into your repair guy, and he says to you, well, to replace that light, it's going to take me a year to take the dashboard apart and get in there and replace the part and put it back together. I could do it a different way by cutting through the body of the car and leave you with a ugly body, but that's still going to take me 4 months, so come back in 4 months. That's how Lockheed Martin designed Orion. It's ludicrous. At the same time they announced this problem, SpaceX was able to quickly switch out multiple engines on a Falcon 9 so it could launch with engines that they had that were trustworthy. If there was an issue with the engines, they wanted to make sure that it was not going to be a problem. They were able to switch them out and do so in a matter of a couple of weeks. And of course, with Starship, the eighth prototype, they switched out Raptor engines in a matter of weeks.
Weeks.
The same purpose. You compare, and that's how you build a real product, a designed, well-designed product. And Orion might actually, they might have to fly Orion on its first mission on SLS in order to avoid that delay with a power unit that doesn't work. So whether it'll launch on schedule in November 21 is still questionable, but November 21, at this moment in time, based on the progress that Starship and SpaceX is making, it would not surprise me if they make orbit prior to November of 21.
Webb is supposed to launch October 31st of 2021.
Oh, okay. And now you all right. I knew there was a delay from the March launch, so they delayed it 6 months to October. I had forgotten the specifics. That's why I was a little unsure about that. So, okay, October 21. And the last thing I heard without seeing the date was they're still on schedule to meet that date. And I suspect at this point they will. Let's keep our fingers crossed that the thing works once it's That's another problem. Because it's going to be a million miles away from Earth, and there will be no way to fix it. It won't be Hubble. So let's pray it works. They spent a lot of time building it, and I will say the planetary and astronomy community has a generally good record on this. So we can be optimistic,
optimistic,
we shouldn't
but nervous.
Be blind to the risks.
Optimistic but nervous.
Yeah, you're very nervous. I've been very nervous about Webb now for more than, since I wrote Universe in a Mirror, my third book on Hubble Space Telescope, I've been nervous about Webb all that time because what I learned with Hubble tells me that there are great risks. And trust me, Webb is as far more cutting edge in engine technology
than anything probably
than Hubble was. Far more.
It
really is. And so there's risks involved, great risks.
Any final message for 2020?
Everyone should have a happy new year. They should have a great Christmas. They should go to lots of Christmas and New Year's parties. Don't live in fear, because there isn't a lot to be afraid of. That's what I would say for the coming rest of the year.
All right. And listeners, I'm doing Coast to Coast tonight at 10 o'clock California time. So if you want to listen to it, you probably know where to go to listen to it already. And if you've never heard of it and you don't know where to go, you probably don't want to stay up that late to listen to it. But I'm not sure what I'll be talking about with George, but I'm on the first part of Coast to Coast tonight for those of you who stay up late and want to hear it. And we'll be back Friday talking about space solar power and economics with the guys from the Center for Space Policy and Strategy. And then Sunday, Moonwards will debut their new program with us. So everybody have a great week, and stay safe and stay healthy. And as always, keep looking up and keep looking at Jupiter and Saturn, because it is way cool and it's not yet the 21st. So good night from Bob, good night from David, and good night from the Space Show.